Rule Galloway, Spinners of Yarns with Russ
Foreman.
Foreman. From Aberdeen.
As opposed to Foreman.
Yeah. From Aberdeen?
From Aberdeen, yeah. From Ellen in the northeast of Scotland, yes. Born in Forrester Hill Hospital. And
that's just a bit outside of Aberdeen?
Yeah, 16 miles further north towards Peterhead. Yeah.
And how was it growing up up in Aberdeen?
Well, growing up in Aberdeen for me was excellent. You know, family were from Cruden Bay, which was on the beach just beside, so we spent the summers there, and I was very fortunate. My old man had a good job. My mum was into music and fashion. She'd opened a boutique. She was a music teacher, and she opened a boutique. So we were, you know, what you would class as semi-affluent. And I was taking on holidays and things like that when I was a kid, so I had a great time growing up in Aberdeen, yeah.
And kind of like, you remember your school experience, did you enjoy literature whilst you were at school?
Yeah, quite the opposite. I mean, I didn't like my school. When I think back on, I was at a posh school, I went to a fee-paying school, because I think I showed a bit of aptitude when I was younger. And they put me into this all-boys school, and when I look back, I didn't realise it at the time because I wasn't thinking about it at the time, but when I look back on it, it was a bit of a joke, really. A lot of the teachers were done and ended up committing suicide or with child abuse.
Wow.
Bill Bain, my physics teacher, Billy Simpson, the physics teacher, and the scout leaders at the school, they all got caught, and it wasn't a good school, man. But you know what it did? It taught you confidence. It gave you confidence that no matter what, everything would be all right. I mean, you think about it. I never got taught how to be an electrician. It was never in the. If we were going into the army, for instance, we were going into officer level. You know, we were going into Biggins Hill, and we were getting taught, but we were never going to go in as a soldier. You know, and when I think on that, you were conditioned that way. And I don't agree with any of it, but I really liked rugby. And I was good at it. But then again, I got picked for the Scottish schoolboys, and my teacher never told me. Because we were playing the grammar school. But we were playing the grammar school.
Yeah.
And he didn't tell me that they'd been selected.
Yeah.
There was some issue with a phone call. Phone calls were going into my music teacher, and thought it was me.
Right.
And it wasn't. And I think that they just believed they couldn't catch me, and it was me, because all of a sudden the school reports were terrible, and I was dropped from getting picked for the Scottish selection. After school, when I'd left, I was at a party and with the rugby lot, because I continued it for a couple of years, and the selector was there, and he came out and said, "I picked you for Scotland," and I'm like, "What?" And he's like, "Chuck Faulkner, your teacher, he wouldn't let you do it." No, it's like, but my whole life path would have changed. And he's like, "Well, I picked you," and he didn't let you do. So I think my school was primarily run by wankers when I think back on it.
They
did their own agendas and were keeping up appearances, really.
Yeah.
It was more than educating me and making sure I went somewhere in life. I got told I was shit at English. I got told I was shit at art. You know, I've written two books, I've done a lot of art, and I've done a lot of music.
Yeah.
Pretty good at it.
But from what you've said, it probably wasn't that kind of school. They didn't want you to do art and literature, you know.
If you're painting a tree, you know, if you're painting a horse or things like that, aye, but thinking outside of the box, no.
Yeah.
It was absolutely like regurgitation of fact. And, you know, if you had a good memory, you'd have passed that school.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you did what you were told when you were told, and that was it. If you thought outside the box, you were snapped down, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Or you were accused of making funny phone calls to teachers. I remember having to go up to the teacher three times and ask her if she had some chairs. "Excuse me, Mr. Bruce needs some chairs." And they're going, "Sorry, could you say that again?"
Yeah.
And she was listening to my voice to see if it was me. And she must have known it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because they didn't pin it on me.
Yeah.
And it wasn't me.
Yeah.
But then when I think back on it, it was after school, in the same at the rugby club. It was my history teacher, who was the woman's wife, the woman's husband. He married her.
Yeah.
And he said, "You were making those funny phone calls." And I just was like, talking about it, you know. But there. So no, school was, I thought it was schools.
We had the
ones.
We had the Scottish coach as our assistant head.
Right.
The British Lions coach. So we had Jim Telfer. Six foot six with a broken nose. He moved up to, he was assistant head up in Livingston.
Right.
So he was assistant head at Dean's. And he's quite a firesome character you're a 12-year-old kid, you know what I mean?
Aye, too, right, yeah. That was a great team. That was a great team at that time.
He was a good coach. He took us for rugby a few times, you know, and I was more of a football man, but I ended up playing for the rugby team for about 2 months.
Right.
And I was probably better at rugby than football. But all my mates played football, so I went back and played football.
I played the cello, but you know, they made me do it at lunchtime.
Yeah.
When everybody was going to the Wimpy and meeting birds and all that. So I was, I'm never going to use physics. I hate it. Why don't I play the cello instead of, you know, doing these circuit boards?
Yeah.
You know, that I don't even know how to. You know, and I'll never, I couldn't even plug a, I couldn't even wire a plug, you know, but I could play the cello. And I jacked it. Jacked the cello so that I could go and meet lasses in the Wimpy.
That's what
it was
wanted.
No choice at all, you know, for a man of my age, for a kid of my age.
So what year did he leave school then?
I left school in 87.
87.
So thankfully.
Yeah,
just right on the perfect time to catch the new wave of what was happening, you know.
Yeah.
I went to New York that summer.
Okay.
And I went to Mars. I went to some clubs for the first time, you know, and I knew house music at that point. I was into it.
Yeah.
But they were only playing perhaps half an hour of it in the clubs, and I remember asking my friend Rachel if she would dance with me when the house stuff came on.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to look gay. And she said, "Yeah, I'll dance with you. I like it too." And I was driving down to clubs in Manchester and thinking, well, we better bring some style council or something like that. How are we going to listen to house music for 2.5 hours straight on the journey, you know?
That's a bit of a trek from Aberdeen.
Doing 4-hour sets here twice a day now, you know.
I used to work for Shoot, and I used to drive up to Aberdeen to Union Street, innit? And they had a shop there, and
Shoot,
it was a long old drive up there, you know.
I got my Puma Californias in Shoot. And my desert boots, used to get my desert boots and my Californias there.
Yeah.
And pony, the blue and white ponies, I remember getting them in shoes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, wouldn't be seen dead in shoe now.
Yeah.
I wouldn't buy my shoes in shoe.
Yeah.
Well, I might buy the Clarks still. But
so were you going out in Aberdeen in 87 then?
Yeah, was it going to the Pelican.
What was happening at
it? Was a Pelican club.
Pelican.
But it was before, it wasn't the Pelican that people talk about. It was you know, Paz was doing, putting on the Shaman and putting on. Yeah, it was an indie kind of club, it was on a Monday night, and I chaired the Kangaroo Club, I remember they were calling it, and it was a nomadic club.
It wasn't in,
they moved it to Market Street when it became kind of the famous Pelican of Aberdeen.
Yeah.
But no, there was there was that, and there was a club, they hosted the Bang Club in there, which was like the first house music that was up there with Jackie Morrison, Mike Grieve, who runs the Subby now, and Jim Rennie, amongst others. But Aberdeen had a great heritage of Vivian Westwood. The only place outside of the only store she had outside was with Willie Rosedale up in Crown Street. Willie was at the Shum, and you know, these were like close knit. Connection with the clubland of the 80s, same as Edinburgh did too, very much so, with the City Cafe and Steve Strange and all that moving up. The word direct connects. So again, with the football, Aberdeen had been ahead, and I think with the house music it was ahead as well. I think Aberdeen was the first city really in Scotland. Colin Bard would tell you otherwise.
Yogi would tell you otherwise,
but I think for me, Aberdeen was very early on in it. Aye, certainly. Yeah, Yogi would pull me up about that.
He would do. I would start DJing the end of 85, and I met Yogi 86, went to Texas, and I remember walking in and hearing him playing Jack the Groove by Raise.
Right.
And it just sounded so much different to when I played it in the other place, and it was just powerful, and you realise that's how house music needed to be played. He's got a...
Well, I'll give him that. If that was 86, I think that was pre-Band Club.
But it wasn't that busy, you know what I mean? No. In honesty to him, you know, but when he took it over,
the Hooch,
end of 87, when they started the Hooch, that's when it started getting busy. And there was
the Hooch and the Thunderbird. They were the ones that kind of launched it. We were doing, what was the place? It was Oblomov, I think it was called, on the mound. We had a basement in there. And there was about 15, 20 people.
Yeah.
Bootsy was the DJ, and Brainstorm ended up.
Did he move to Edinburgh, didn't he, Bootsy?
Bootsy, aye. He was a like soul DJ packed it in. He stopped DJing.
Yeah.
But it was him and Yogi were the two DJs that everyone kind of looked up to in Edinburgh at the time.
Yeah.
And there was like Wilkie House, I remember.
Yeah. Dave Alexander and Colin and Lil Wan.
You know what was brilliant then was the relaxed all weekend, though.
Yeah, yeah.
That club was fucking amazing.
Which one was that?
The absolute insanity that was by the dude that did the Shavers Weekly.
Right.
And there was naked people in it, and there was competitions.
Was that Fred?
Fred. Yeah. And Big Lorna.
Fred was great at PR, because he had this PR in the Sunday Mail once about kind of like sex going on in his clubs.
Yeah.
Me and Yogi went up on a Sunday night. Nothing happened.
Above Costa. That was it. Yeah.
We were like this. We stayed about half an hour. We sacked it off.
I saw quite a lot happening.
Did you?
Like, in that place. It seemed quite wild. Like the games of dares that they had for Six Red Stripes.
Yeah, yeah.
Blind boxing.
Yeah.
Ski jumps.
Yeah.
They would play Motorhead, and then they would play Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
And then they would destroy a fridge. And they would just say, like, six cans to the first person to bring us back a bin bag through the street.
Yeah.
And folk would run out into the street.
Yeah.
But I mean, they got stopped because they had a naked volleyball competition on and leaf links.
Right.
And they were getting away with that.
Yeah.
And then they lined up 20 pence pieces on the park bench and said, right, first person to bring us a Mars bar gets six. It was always a six pack of Red Stripe.
Yeah, yeah.
First person gets a Mars bar. So everyone who was naked just stopped playing volleyball, grabbed the 20 pence. And headed to the first shop.
Yeah.
And when the guy in the shop, all he had was 20 naked people running in. And I think he suffered 4 facial cuts with the 20 pences getting thrown at him. And people was just grabbing the Mars bars and running, taking the 20, grabbing them. And then that got in the front page of the News of the World or something, that did.
Yeah,
that was. And then they had to change its name. That's when it turned into Shavers Weekly.
Right.
But for me, that was the best Edinburgh club.
Okay.
That was the one that was the most eye-opening. Yeah.
So because we talked about this when we first met a few years ago, because I remember DJing at UFO on the Sunday night
at
the venue.
Yeah, Sunday
and,
night.
With Craig Smith, and it only lasted 6 months, 9 months or something like that. I never really talked. And then it went into Pew after that.
Yeah, UFO. There was UFO, but I think it was a Friday UFO. And then
UFO was a Sunday, definitely, because I was doing a soul club down in Carlton Studios, and so I kind of like, I popped along to the venue. Brad was there, Figs was there, and kind of like did my set for an hour or whatever it was, and then went back to Carlton Studios.
Well, as I remember it, it was, we did a Sunday night, because we had MC Kinky up, and we had some other, but Yogi was doing that, but that wasn't a UFO. As I remember that, UFO was on the front, because it just, there was a riot at UFO. At the Paris Angels gig.
Right, okay.
And then the following week, it became Pure.
Right.
So it just changed, it became a members only club.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It was on the, it was a Friday.
It was a Friday. Pure was Friday, but when the UFO definitely started on the Sunday night.
Or maybe it kicked off on a Sunday and moved to Friday.
Yeah.
That explains it then.
Yeah.
Because that was this year, I was trying to figure, I remember putting on Karen Geary, Kinky.
Yeah.
I remember putting her on, and because she played in Glasgow on the Saturday. And there was a funny incident, because I remember that. And then she ended up through an end earlier than expected. she got run out of Glasgow, basically.
But that was the point when I'd moved off, you know what I mean? 1991, I moved down to Hull, so I didn't really spend a lot of time in Edinburgh. Edinburgh was changing. After that, you had the... what was the place opposite? The Usher Hall.
I remember that, the Lemon Tree or something
Lemon,
like that, was
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
Citrus
like that.
Club.
Citrus Club, that's it,
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's when that started to take off. And
Havana were doing in there, and it was soft.
It
wasn't like, but we were, Sativa and that, they started up, and then, because they were all saying the Pure was soft. You know, I mean, there was nothing soft about it. We were playing Stack of Humanoid and things like that. It wasn't soft, you know. But
Pew was a big legendary Edinburgh club.
Oh hell yeah, yeah, all over the world. Pew's known. Yeah, I mean, not now so much. The kids, a lot of notes in that. The kids aren't maybe perhaps so aware now, but certainly I rode the Pew horse for 25 years. You know, it was, you know, it gets you a lot of credibility, a lot of respect.
Yeah.
All over the world.
Yeah.
People have heard of it. Primarily because of the DJs that came talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, and then we ended up with a diaspora of people that were going to the club, like Neil Landstrom and like Sativa. They all branched out. You know, like in a big way. You know, there was a lot of people came out of the Stephen Brown. There was a lot of techno artists came out of Pure.
Yeah.
DJ Q, all citing it as inspirational. You know, like so. Yeah, the word got about, and we were very famous. But because of Pure, I never went anywhere else. You know, like people say, "Oh, did you go to Basics? Did you go?" I never got the chance. We did it every fucking week. For 8 years. When you think about it, you know, like we didn't go anywhere else. I never went to Ibiza until 2009. You know, I thought it was rubbish, and it was probably right.
Yeah.
You know, like it certainly wasn't as good as what we were doing. There's no way it could have been. You know.
I mean, it's not as good now as it was.
No, well, yeah, I bet it's not to say that, but you know, I like it now, but then I'm an old guy.
Yeah. But you live over there for...
I lived there for 7 years in April. Yeah, I've been there 6 years and I've done great. You know, it's been really good to us. So, yeah, I love Ibiza. It's got a good attitude and you've got to bring it. Yeah, you can't look for anyone to help you. It won't roll out the red carpet. As soon as you ask somebody for something, it's all over. You know, like people ask me constantly to DJ at Pipe and things like that nature. And it's for them, you know. It's not for the good of the place. It's not because they want to help improve it.
Yeah.
And the people that do live there, that are my friend, they're very high standard, very high quality. It's a DJ, Pat Phil Cooper, and you know, like people that are shit hot and dedicated their lives to it.
Yeah.
And you know, some people are asking you to come in. Well, we've got a vodka sponsor, you know. And you're all right. So you're going to put posters of vodka up all over Pikes, where everyone's going to be doing shots. That's going to be great, you know. Yeah. And it's a bit like that. So I get a lot of that. But the thing I like about Ibiza is that nobody needs anything from me.
Yeah.
They're all sorted, you know, and I'm the same. I don't need MD to do, but I'm contributing. Yeah, yeah. I'm just bringing it, you know. And then you collaborate. Don't get me wrong. It's not like a bunch of individuals.
How often do you DJ then?
I play about 3 or 4 times a week. You know, like I try not to keep it more than five gigs a week. Is it? You know, you need 2 days off and one after the other really to keep your mental health. You're going for April or October right through non-stop.
Yeah.
And it's getting hot. You know, it's 90 degrees for 2 of those months. You know, there's a lot of people there. And like I say, you've got to keep up the standards. So, you know, it's easy to slip, and you see people slipping left, right, and centre. You know, and you can see it coming. You can see it in the post. You know that you're overdoing it.
Yeah.
You know, and you need to drink water and sleep.
Yeah.
You know, but pressure's on, and of course you're very pressurised by other people around. You can slip in and do your job. You know, so you've to really know the score in Ibiza. I've found people come and go.
Yeah.
You know, like you'll get your redundancy for the rigs, you know, and you'll bring your 60 pals you'll be the flavour of the month for the first 3 weeks in every bar you go to because you're packing them out. But after a month or two, such and such as somebody $5,000 for a, you know, for a deal that's went wrong and, you know, so they're divorced and, you know, they ended up plastering villas in the north of the island, like was probably what you should have been doing all along, you know. You've come over here with your big ideas about becoming a DJ. Really, you're a roustabout, mate, you know. You should let the DJs be the DJs. but you see that all the time in Ibiza, People treat it like it's a Disneyland, you know, and it is, but you've got to keep the head, you know.
So if you left school and literature wasn't your thing, you know, when did you decide that you were going to write the first book? Harry's Kebabs was the first one.
I wasn't until I was in my 40s. What happened was we were going to Notting Hill Carnival annually, and basically my pal Malcolm, who was running squat parties in London for People for People, they were called, who's living in Marylebone. And he's just a hardcore individual, he's the heart of a bull, and he fell and hit his head in this pub that we used to go to. Like, the good times was where we would hang out at Notting Hill.
Yeah.
On the Monday, and we went to this pub and he fell and hit his head. It was a small raised stage, one of those small stages that are only about that off the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
Couldn't crack, and he really caught himself a dillion, and then bizarrely the next year he did exactly the same.
Yeah.
But in that year, the second year, he had a blackout, and like I said, he was a hardcore man. He walked into Harrow Road and carjacked a guy, told him he had to take him to the hospital. And he did. So he took him to the hospital, and then he was in the hospital for whatever it was.
Yeah.
And then on the I was a Monday, Tuesday, went. But the Thursday, I phoned him up and said, "How's your head?" And he said, "Well, do you know I got mugged? I got mugged." And I was like, "No, you never get mugged. You slipped and hit your head." And he, "Well, do you know what happened?" And I'm like, "I was like that." I said, "And then you carjacked a guy in Martin Harrow Road." I was like, and he's like, and I'm like, "I was like, you were a one man army, mate." And he got, and I says, "And your wife took your wallet." They got my wallet, and I'm like, "Your wife took your wallet." long story short, he developed dementia because of those two bangs in the head.
Did he?
And the onset was really quick.
Right.
And he went from being this guy capable of all that to forgetting and wandering up the A1 to heading towards Scotland. Right. He was in Brent Cross, kept getting picked up on the road. You'd have to dress him in a bright orange. And I thought, I'm going to write, he forgot what we'd done, so I thought, I'm going to write down what we did.
Yeah, yeah.
To jog your memory.
Yeah, yeah.
And after 3 weeks, I'd written 19,000 words.
Three weeks.
I remember Carly, my pal, was doing a thesis. 10,000. Right. Oh, this bloody thesis, 10,000. And take me all you. And I was like, wait a minute, I've just written 19. I'm not getting marked in it. But I'm not getting marked, but it's fine.
Yeah.
I've still written 19,000 words. How many words is in a book? You know, so I Googled it. How many words in a book? 50,000 words is a novel.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, well, I'm going to write a book for him.
Yeah.
You know, I'll write a book for Malcolm.
Yeah, yeah.
This is, how do I do that?
Yeah.
So I said, how do I write a book? And then my pal Spawny, he gave me, don't tell anyone, but I hadn't read that many books.
Okay, like, I won't tell anybody.
At the time, I'd written more books than I'd read at the time.
Right.
But at one point.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
I will say that, and I get told not to say that. But it was that that inspired me to write the book, and I thought, you know, I'll write 50,000 words. I'll write that in another 5 weeks. I've written 19,000 in 3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
4.5 years later, you know, I've finished it.
Right.
You know, and then Malcolm passed at the beginning of COVID, but I did. Right. I got the chance to read a few chapters too.
So what did how did he get somebody to edit it?
I had wrote it, and then I got my pal John, who was another London head from nuclear free zone, like down in Brixton, Cold Harbour Lane, the 414 Club, that mob. So one of them did it. And then I got another geezer called Mike Boorman, who's a friend of mine in Ibiza, to edit it as well. And then I got John De Silva's wife, Jo, to proofread it all.
Okay.
But then I largely ignored a lot of the advice I'd been given, and there was a lot of mistakes in my writing. But then that became a bit endearing, and then after a while it was like, no, it's mistake. These are mistakes.
Yeah.
So I've been constantly re-editing that book. I still am. Every time I pick it up, I see a wee mistake. I've seen you say that.
That's the problem with creating, isn't it? You kind of like, you always see flaws later down the line, and
somebody's got to stop
some
you.
At some point, you've got to go, that's it.
Got to tell you. That's enough, man. It's good. You know, leave that as it is. Work on a remix or work on.
So you had the book ready to go. How did you get it published then?
I got it published out myself, man. I didn't even think about selling copies. I wasn't wanting to do it. It was a book for my friend.
Right,
I wanted
him
to remember incidents, and that was it.
Yeah.
I didn't think about it. It was an achievement for me.
Yeah.
But it was a creative process. It was for me and me alone.
Yeah.
And I didn't think on any commercial side of things or anything. But then Amazon, it turned out, had just started publishing books for self-published authors.
Right, yeah.
And it was right that year that they I think it was 2019, whatever.
Yeah.
I looked into it, and it was a piece of cake, man. So I just did that. And then overnight, I sold 139 copies. And then I was like, oh, bloody hell, wait
a
minute.
That's not bad overnight.
Yeah, it was great overnight.
That's really good. How did he do that then? Social media?
Yeah, just my mates. It was promoting a club. I'd just done DJ'd, come to my gig.
Yeah.
You know, it was the same, buy my book.
Yeah.
You know, and then they started sharing it.
Yeah.
Oh, there's this book's come out.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was Luke Solomon, from Classic. He was the first one that, you know, I got sent, have you seen this?
Yeah.
You know, and it was an Instagram post with Luke's ace new book on rave culture. And Johnny Rock pulled me up in Pikes 2 weeks later. Oh, this is Rusty's an author. Oh, yeah, what'd you write? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, wait, I've got your book.
Yeah.
And how the hell did you get my book? It's the best book I've ever read. Wait a minute, somebody set this up.
Yeah,
looking for Candid Camera, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, there was Luke that he'd told them all about it.
Yeah.
And so I just blew up. But then that 139 people,
yeah,
you know, 50, 60 of them are writing back to me saying, there's a blank page on, you know, yeah, chapter 3. You know, that you've, there's a spelling mistake here. Yeah. You know, you've spelled Gypsy with a Y or with a P, with an I, you know what I mean?
But I think that's because I
thought, oh Christ, I better get on with it. I've written a book.
I sent the first issue of Spinners to the head of English of my school, right? And I left school with no qualifications. I got kicked out of English.
The
school wasn't for me.
Brilliant.
And he came back and because he's been taught all the rules and regulations of English, and he's like, you know, going, there's flaws. I'm like, I know, but that's what it, literature is not about the flaws. It's
exactly
about getting it down on paper. And you know, I interviewed a lad called Colin Burnett, who's just published his second book, who's Aldo, and he writes in a Scottish dialect in Edinburgh.
I'm friends with him on Instagram, I think.
And his first two books have been really good, and you know, he suffers from dyslexia,
right,
and a few other things, so it's a struggle for him to do it. But you know, he writes in the way that he talks, which is, you know,
that's how I do it.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the thing, you know. It was pretty much alliteration. You know, like grammatical styles that you would get taught about.
Yeah.
And then if you used them in your essays, then you would get better marks. But it didn't occur to me that we were being taught these things to use them.
Yeah.
You know, so when I got told to write an essay, I was like, yes, and just started writing an essay. And then I'd keep getting the same C+.
Yeah.
C+. And I was like, that was a good one, you know.
Yeah,
what was wrong with that?
Yeah.
But it was because I didn't use. And then I remembered using this phrase, the clinical clean climb. And the clinically clean climb in a hospital, and I got a 19 for that one, and I got a circle round it, and then I remember the penny dropped. I went, that's what they were teaching us about. I must have to use what they're teaching us about.
Yeah.
And the essays, and then I'll get better marks.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, that's a lot of wank, isn't it? You know what I mean? I mean, I did like Shakespeare. I did enjoy it, but I was like,
for me, literature is about contemporary writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you know, I want to read something that I can connect to, and but when I went to university, and I went when I was 24, so I got my O grades and my highs a bit later.
Right, right.
And I did literature at uni, and
okay,
one of the first.
What uni was that?
I went to Hull.
Okay.
So we there was the old Polytechnic as it was, Humberside.
Right.
And then the first assignment was about Agatha Christie and her style of writing. And I'm like, fucking hell, what do I do here?
Mm.
You know, I've never done one before. So I spoke to the head of English, and he gave me a formula.
Right.
So I wrote mine, put mine in. The lecturer panned every single person in the room apart from me.
Wow.
And it was only because he'd given me the formula to write what they're looking for.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so and that is what a lot of education is about.
If you get that first paragraph, almost the same one.
Yeah,
you could write the same, and then the last paragraph, your first thing, you've only got to fill in that middle bit.
Exactly.
You know, what can go wrong? You know, how wrong can it go?
So the first book was going successful. What's the title of the second book?
Take the Takeaway.
Okay.
So there's the Carrie's Kebabs.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, and then there's the Takeaway.
Yeah.
So like the Takeaway, without any spoilers, but at the end of the Carrie's Kebabs, there's a caper. Basically, and they have to get out of London.
Yeah.
So they take themselves away. That's kind of the premise, and they bolt out of London, and the story continues about what happens on that road trip kind of thing. It's kind of a road trip novel. That's the Takeaway. But Harry's Kebabs, I mean, I've just broken all sales records in December and January. I mean, that's 4.5 years that's been out, and I sold more copies than I've ever sold in December. And in January, you never sell books in January.
No.
I sold the same amount as I sold at Christmas.
But there's usually some kind of, like, somebody's put it on social media or
I think a lot of people are going to Goa.
Right,
and a lot of people are going on holiday, like the Faith Lot. They were all away to
Goa.
A lot of people took it there.
Yeah.
You know, because I know, because they send me pictures from Instagram.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So maybe perhaps there's a lot of holiday goers were reading my book in January, but none of that really matters because it shouldn't be happening. No. You know, they should have fizzled out 3 months after it came out, really.
Yeah.
But it hasn't.
How many books in total have you sold?
I don't know, but it's thousands now. Okay. You know, but I don't know.
That's brilliant. No.
Yeah, yeah. It's a few. It's not. I don't think it's 10,000, but it's probably five. You know, something like I really don't know. Yeah. I mean, I look at it on a month to month.
Yeah.
I've some good months and some bad. This month isn't going too good.
No.
But I've learned to not sweat that.
Yeah.
And it's just usually. I also find that if I do an Instagram post, I sell a book. And if I don't, I don't.
Yeah, yeah.
So as soon as I really kind of get my head together and get a bunch of good pictures with people in them, perhaps a couple of famous DJs or sports stars or somebody that people know, usually sees a spike in sales.
Yeah.
Like when, you know, Steve Davis, somebody like that, you know, you'll see a good few because you tag them.
Yeah, yeah.
And all the fans see it. Jimmy White's in my book, you know, he loves it. He wrote to me about it.
Yeah.
He was like, "Oh, ordinarily, you know, you'd have to get in touch with my manager." He says, "But I've read it and I really like it, mate."
Yeah.
And then I've had a couple of likes from him, from Jimmy White, just on comments, because he used to play up in the windmill in Cricklewood.
Right.
And he played my mate Malcolm. Okay. He was a pool fanatic. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that's how that all came about, that first opening chapter. Because it all happened, everything in my book happened, because it was me reminding Malcolm about what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's all set in this house up in Hendon,
right,
as well. He was in Marylebone and then he went up to ended up in Hendon.
What's the third one then? Is there a third one?
There's a third one, but it's not related.
Okay.
So it's a new guy. I've got a new, it's directly related to my life. Because I think most fiction is just like your own experiences fictionalised. You know, like I think that's the way it seems to go. But the third one's a poisoner. He just poisons rotters.
Yeah.
So he's a nice poisoner. Like you like him.
Okay.
You know, and he's like a vigilante poisoner.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's my pal again. My pal got diagnosed prostate cancer.
Right.
He's a front man for a band. He was in a lot of bands back in the days with the Shaman and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah.
Edith and the Ladies, and he's like as Glasgow punk, like that kind of age, he got this prostate diagnosis. He refused the treatments. I was DJing a lot in Amsterdam at the time, and I had a hookup with this guy with the oil treatments, whatever, the tinctures that you got for it. So he started using them. But because he's a front man, and he's always like up singing songs in the pub, and, you know, he's a very forward guy. He went on Facebook, started writing his memoir because he thought he'd 18 months to go.
Yeah.
In it, he's fessed up that he poisoned his uncle when he was 14 because he was abusing him, and then he did another guy in Muswell Hill when he was 30 because he had him running about on a drug debt that he got himself involved in. This guy had him running about with 15 years worth in his motor every day, you know, getting given however much it was, a wee bag or whatever at night, and he had to stop it. He had to get out of that.
So he
poisoned him as well, but he never killed either of them. He just fucked him up enough and they never messed with him again. And I sat and looked at him. Of course, he's written this on Facebook, and I'm thinking, what are you doing? You know, like he's just a me type, you know.
Yeah.
He went back to the doctors after 6 months for his checkup, and his counts went from 94 down to 2, and he hasn't got it anymore, and he's fessed it all up. And I just thought, that's a book, mate.
I'm going to
write a book about that.
Yeah.
And so that just set me spinning, set my mind. So then I just thought, right, okay, who would I like to seen poisoned in my, you know, in my days, you know? And I just go through my life and I think,
I had diabetes 2 7 years ago,
right?
And I got wheeled out to, you know, to take metformin,
right?
And I said, no, I'm not going to take it. It's daft, is it? It's just that you've got too much blood sugars in your body.
Yeah.
What do? You cut down on all the sugar.
Just sugar, right?
I turned it around in about 4 months.
Right.
You got to keep on top of it all the time, and particularly over the last couple of years, it's really difficult.
And is that just like your diet?
That's
like
my diet.
At regular times and things like that?
My diet. I don't eat anything processed.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because I find now if I eat something processed, I start getting a bit lethargic.
Right, right.
You know? And I got told 3 years ago that I had, 2.5 years ago, that I had a flour allergy.
Right.
And that is kind of, this is after struggling for 2 or 3 years, right, thinking you're okay.
Stay away, stay away for the forget me nots.
Yeah. But then suddenly it's just like, you know, it was a, something happened. I'm like, hold on, this is exactly the way that I should feel.
Right.
And then it becomes a struggle eating processed foods that's not got flour in it.
Right, yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's just easier to go, you know, I'm not going to eat flour.
So, the
third book, you're over in London, you recorded some music with Ewan and Athens.
I've done a new EP with Athens of the North Eye. I've just done with Linkwood, with Nick. So it's me and him, it's called, I'm called For Mankind for that one. I've been in London DJing. I've started a new club called Acid for Breakfast with Leo Zero over in Deptford in Millwall Scar Park. I've been doing a lot of DJing, Brilliant Corner, Spiritland, Campfire up in King's Cross, down at Ballamy Radio with Medlar. I'm going into the studio with Medlar tomorrow. It's really been mental. Like, I came here to write my book, and I did for 8 days, you know, but then the DJing took off again, and I can't do the two, Raoul, man. It's one or the other. I can't be the character and have to look through promos as Russ. I have to be me to do that. And I can't be, and my character's called Yule, my main character. I can't be Yule. And this book is a confessional. Yeah. It's just Yule fessing up, really. But he's got his anecdotes as he goes along. I remember this night, and this is what happened there. And it all ties in quite interestingly, because there was a lot of stuff that I was going through in New York. It's based in New York. There's a lot of stuff I was going through in New York that came out later to be of massive political and international significance that I didn't realise at the time. But when I think back on it now, that's what was going down, and those were the people involved. And I can't say who it is or what it is for fear of anything happening, but I'm changing that. I'm changing the names in the book, you know. But this is like famous international incidents that everyone knows about that I was pretty much party to. I was one step away from them going down where they were happening Uptown New York, in the Upper East Side of New York. So I mean, it wouldn't take too much more than that to really give away what I was talking about, but I knew people that were involved in a massive scandal that was going on up there, so I've tied that in to the book. But I couldn't say that because I could you know, get an umbrella, you know, in my shin, you know, like when I'm walking down Oxford Street, you know. I don't want to noise anybody up. I don't want to be scaled.
None of us want that. But you've also contributed to the lit scene Spinners as well.
Yeah.
With a bit of poetry.
Yeah, that was great.
The second
issue. Well, I started writing poems, which are basically just me talking. But the grammar's correct. You know, that's it. And I realised that. So then I started writing poems about things. Like, I would listen to Ornette Coleman, and then I'd write a song about the tune that I was listening to, Lonely Woman, for instance. I wrote a poem about Lonely Woman. And then that kind of developed into just me remembering stuff and telling stories like about one night at Loch Lomond, there was a and turning that into a poem, you know, and just writing like that. And then asked me to submit a poem, and I was thinking, what am I going to write about? And as I was thinking that, I thought, well, I should write this down. That I can't think what I'm thinking of. And then that became the poem. By the time I'd got to the end of thinking, right, what am I going to write for this poem? I'd written a poem about what am I going to write for this poem? What am I writing about? And I'd written a poem. And I thought, right, okay, I'll just send that. So the whole thing took 10 minutes. You know, it was just a freestyle of poetry. So I love doing that now. And I'll go through bursts. And I think some of it's good and some of it isn't. Obviously, that's my thing. This Spinners, there's a lot more content than I thought there was going to be, and I'm really impressed with the layout and the look of it, and I'm delighted that I'm in this.
Thank you for contributing. You know,
I'm over the moon about this.
You know, it's it takes a bit of time. It's a free publication, you know. So, in you know, we ask for contributions online. So, if you can afford it, then put some money in. If you can't, okay, then not an issue.
Yeah, no.
But it's helping to create awareness for writers. You know what I mean? So that's a key side of it.
Exactly.
Whether it's literature or short stories.
Yeah, you know? I mean, yeah, that's the thing. It's just you can write about anything, can you?
Yeah.
You know, as long as it's well written, as long as it's interesting. I think about mixes and writing in the same. There's momentum and there's holding the attention of the listener or the dancer and not losing the floor.
You
know, like, and it's exactly the same. So my punctuate and I write paragraphs that are short.
Yeah.
So to keep that thing, and it's all related to mixing. It's all related to DJing.
Yeah.
But I think this. The stuff in here is of that nature as well, you know. It's like it's relatable and it's fun, you know, like, and that's what keeps you reading it.
I think one of the mate Dean Cavanaugh published a book last year, and what I find good about
I'd
his
love to
book
meet Dean,
all his paragraphs were the same length.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, and that's because there's nothing worse when you're reading a paragraph and it's like 80 pages.
I hate that.
You know,
I'm thinking about what I'm going to have for my what am I going to have for my tea halfway through it. I'm going to have to read that 7 times. That's exactly what I made all of mine 2 or 3 lines long.
Yeah.
Because I thought, right, well, when I'm reading it, I'm looking at it and think, oh, well, hang it, it's only another 3 lines. I'll just read it.
Yeah.
You know, like, and then they think, oh, wait a minute, it's only another, and then you just keep carrying on. Before you know it, you've got 10 pages down when you were thinking about knocking it on the head. But it would take one paragraph that filled the majority of a page to put me off picking up that book for days.
Yeah.
You know, I'd have got to that point and it would be like it would be like Beecher's Brook.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be like an obstacle in my way to the finish line. You know, like, I'm gonna have to read this.
Yeah.
You know, what a pain in the arse.
Yeah.
You know, when it's so chop that paragraph into two-line, three-line sentences, and you know, I'll batter through it over there and I'll enjoy it.
Yeah,
you know?
That's good. Right. One last thing. So, where did DJ Dribbler come from?
I got called it by Sticker from the Shaman.
Okay.
And Wilbur, my mate Wilbur, he got called Wilbur as well.
Right.
And basically, I was practicing. I used to correct when you were doing my vinyl.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was always pushing and tapping.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, "What are you DJing or dribbling?" Like, it was a basketball thing, because I was touching the record much.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there was that dribble thing, obviously, and that was that. But I had nothing to do with that name.
Right.
And I don't really like that name.
Okay.
And but I've been stuck with it,
it.
And people have pulled me up and said, "You've got to change that name." And I'm like, "Well, I've had it for 35 years. Like, you know, do I?"
Yeah.
And but I have for the releases. I'm called Forming Kind now.
Yeah.
And I will probably phase it out. And start using my name. But I always thought, I don't know, there's just something about calling yourself DJ Willie Smith, you know, that I thought was rubbish.
Also,
I came from like the hip-hop era when the DJs had nicknames.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a highly illegal activity we were doing.
Right,
you know, it was fucking stupid putting your name on a flyer.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because if you were doing illegal stuff, you were breaking the law.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it was DJs were going to sign on to get your insurance, your income support for your records.
Yeah, yeah.
And the guy behind the counter comes to pew every week.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, right, I'll get you in the barriers for free. You know, like, I'll get you at the arches on Saturday. You know, and he's like, "All right, it's all looking forward this week." I mean, Mr. Foreman, you know, and I'm like, I do. Yes, I am, Paul. I mean, Mr. Smith, you know. But that was the thing about the name. Yeah, just everyone, we all came up with mad names. Twitch, Brainstorm, Dribbler, Fidget.
Yeah.
We all Yogi, you know, but we all had daft names,
that you
could get the piss taken out of you for now.
But yeah.
it was only a bit after that that everyone started using their real names, and I noticed they were the ones making all the money.
Exactly. Russ Foreman, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, really enjoyed that. Thanks.